He's in there laughing his ass off because he knows more about the law than you do.
I'm here live. I'm not a cat.
My law is thy legal.
I will make it legal.
Objection, Your Honor! Strangling a witness!
I'm going to allow it.
We disagree.
That's it? We disagree?
Well, I can't say we agree. That's how I lost my first 10 cases.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 496. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How you doing, sir?
I am fantastic, Thomas, and I actually mean that.
So. Yeah. I've got a terrible announcement, Andrew.
Okay.
I've shut down my blog.
After.
Yeah, so I had a blog, and then I realized it wasn't 2005, so.
Right.
I had to shut it down.
and you're not a lawyer. Like, apparently, 95% of the, like, legal awards are all still blogs.
Oh, right? Really?
Like, yeah. It's like, there's a category for blogs, there's a category for, like, you know, faxes, I think.
Yeah.
Ham radio broadcasts, but, like,
and I guess Trump didn't win one of those blog awards, and so he had to shut his blog down. It's heartbreaking, truly a heartbreaking tale.
Yeah.
I laughed out loud when I saw the news that he shut down his blog. And it really goes to show, in seriousness, though, it goes to show that the Twitter ban is real. That does work. Like, it worked with Milo Yiannopoulos. It's going Trump. I don't think he can win in 2024 without social media. Now, I do think that they will just find an excuse to put him back and then he'll win and we have to deal with that. But so don't think I'm like some huge optimist. But if somehow, I think Zuckerberg already let him back, but the Twitter guy, if he didn't let Trump back, I actually think it's a huge blow to Trump. And the evidence of that is he had a pathetic blog that no one read, and then he shut it down after 28 days or something like that.
I think social science research agrees with your intuitions there.
Well, let's get to the law for today.
Let's do that.
We've got some really interesting stuff. You want to tell some people what we're not covering today?
I do. I want to tell people two things we're not covering today, right? So first, a dozen of you have emailed me about the Stephen Donziger case. We're aware of it, but all of the things that you find interesting about that case are things that we're not qualified to evaluate yet, right? Like the conditions of the house arrest and X, Y, and Z. And I will tell you, Stephen Donziger is not somebody who's without a voice, right? He's been on The Daily Show. The House Progressive Caucus, including Jamie Raskin, has formally asked the DOJ to investigate his disbarment. So the likelihood that we will get public information in the form of documents that we can review and then cover is reasonably high. And, you know, policy of the show, like, you don't need us to regurgitate facts that are out there in other media outlets that are not, you know, part of legal documents.
If there's not a document out there for Andrew to Scrooge McDuck into, he's not covering. He told me that explicitly when we started the show.
I like reading words. What can I say? All right. But secondly, next week, our goal is to make a 100% shareable episode with your Uncle Frank or with anybody in your family or friend of circle, you know, circle of friends who is involved in or is considering a Christian healthcare sharing ministry.
Oh.
It is a huge scam. It's way worse than you think. It has nothing to do with whether, you know, like you and I, whether you're an atheist or not, like, no one should be involved in this. And I'm going to tell the story of, like, why this came on my radar, this totally irresponsible piece from Market, all that good stuff. And, you know, hopefully you can share that out and scare straight some of your, you know, family members into not participating in those kinds of programs.
Yeah, we may have disagreements here with your uncle's Frank, but if you care about your uncle Frank, you probably don't want them to get taken in by a huge scam. So this is probably good for everybody if you tune in next show. Okay, let's get to this show. Down, down. So I hear the Chauvin, you know, obviously they're contemplating like up to 30 years for Chauvin, and his counteroffer was like detention.
indeed it was, right? Yes. So Chauvin's lawyers filed a motion for mitigated departure, right? A downward departure motion. You have every right to do that. This is the flip side of the investigation and findings conducted by the court pursuant to his Blakely waiver, which we've talked about, right? So you otherwise have the right to litigate in front of the jury to determine whether sufficient facts exist to merit an upward departure, which after a Blakely waiver, Chauvin, I think his lawyers very intelligently decided that they would rather have the judge evaluate those facts than the jury. And the judge said, yeah, I found four separate factors that are aggravating factors that warrant an upward departure. And now, and we discussed that at some length when that came out. So now Chauvin's lawyers are arguing to the same judge who found the aggravating factor. No. There really are a bunch of mitigating factors. I will tell you, this memorandum is 17 pages long. It makes one good argument that is a paragraph long. It will not reach any of its stated goals. And the one kind of factor that they've pointed out is something that I expect that the judge will say, yeah, no, you're right on this, but it doesn't change my recommendation. So let's kind of go quickly through it. There are three separate categories of arguments that this memorandum makes. The first, as you've pointed out, as has been correctly pointed out in the press, is a plea to the court to convert the entire sentence, again, this is presumptively a 12 and a half year sentence, right, into, quote, a stringent probationary term, end of quote. There is zero chance that this court is going to say, like, oh, you wascally child, like, yeah, that's right, we'll give you probation. And look, we've talked about this on the show before, sort of the how, as a lawyer, you balance your duty of zealous advocacy to your client to sort of raise all the arguments you're entitled to raise with your obligation to your client of zealous advocacy to build up credibility in the court. And I will tell you again, not a criminal defense lawyer, this category of argument is so bad that my instinct, and again, we have lots of criminal defense attorneys, public defenders, maybe you make this as a matter of course and you don't lose credibility with the judge by setting it out. Write in, let me know. To me, putting this in writing undercuts the one good point that you're going to make later. So here are the entirety of the arguments that are raised by defense counsel for urging the court to use its discretion to grant a downward departure all the way down to probation. So obviously, one category of that is this is a defendant who is amenable to probation. How do we know he's amenable to probation? Because we say he is. And he cooperated with the court during a trial that was public. And what I mean, essentially, the argument there seems to be this isn't Roger Stone, you know, who flaunted the court's orders and, you know, went back and put Judge Amy Berman Jackson in the crosshairs on his website and, you know, all that kind of stuff. We did what the court told us to do is not usually the greatest argument for why you are a model criminal defendant, but they make that argument. They make the argument that he has no criminal history, which is, of course, taken into account on the sentencing chart already. So don't know how much that's going to get you. They make the argument that he's 45 and that cops die young. I wish I were joking about that, but it's like, yeah, you know, he's 45. He's kind of, you'd think this would be the prime of his life, but you know, you're going to put him away in prison for, you know, 12 and a half plus years. And by the time he comes out, he's going to be an old man and cops die early. And so, you know, don't do that to him. To which I would think the judge's response is like, well, try to commit fewer murders when you're 45. That would be my response, right? But, you know, it is what it is. And then the last kind of argument in this section that is a good transition to the next one is the argument that he was a good cop for 19 years and he, quote, had consistently high scores on his annual reviews and was, quote, well regarded by his supervisors and peers, which seems to be part of the problem rather than reason for departing downward. But those are the arguments for probation.
Are you convinced?
I was going to say, I doubt Tucker Carlson is going to feature these arguments, right? Like these are not great arguments. Okay. So, all right. We start with the big ask. Maybe we're setting it up for the moderate ask, which is, okay, at least depart downward from the statutory minimum, right? This is presumptively going to be 150 months. Let's go less than that. Give him a shorter sentence. Here, there are two arguments that are made. And the first one is, I'm just going to read it to you. It's from page 11, because I really think that this is going to backfire. So, quote, here, Mr. Chauvin was unaware that he was even committing a crime. In fact, in his mind, he was simply performing his lawful duty in assisting other officers in the arrest of George Floyd. Mr. Chauvin's is not a typical case in which a person commits, that's a typo, but whatever, an assault that results in the death of another, as is clear from Mr. Chauvin's action. Had he believed he was committing a crime as a licensed police officer, Mr. Chauvin simply would not
arrested
have done
himself.
So.
Yeah. Oh, no, sorry.
His offense is best described as an error made in good faith reliance on his own experience as a police officer and the training he had received, not the intentional commission of an illegal act.
I mean, it's not 100% wrong, you know?
No, it isn't.
It's like, hey, I thought that we're all police officers here, right? I was operating under the idea that, you know, we're allowed to kill a suspect from time to time. And that seems to be fine, right? Why is this my fault? Why is this all coming down on me?
The fact that that's absolutely how it reads, right?
Yeah.
is a strong indication that maybe it's not the kind of thing you should have put into writing, right? Like, because look, the intentionality component of this, the awareness component, has already been adjudicated.
I was going to ask that. Yeah. Doesn't that part of the crime already?
So 100% that you had the requisite scienter under the law.
That's almost like if you said, hey, okay, mitigating circumstances, I didn't do it. And you're like, well, that doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly right. And the fact, I mean, to me, if I were the judge, I would look at this and go, yeah, I mean, this is an ongoing
trial about
proof
this, buddy. Like,
of lack of remorse. That's right.
Yeah.
Right? Like what you want to see in a downward departure motion, right? And again, I'm most familiar with these in the federal system in connection with the federal sentencing guidelines. They're not my area, but you want to see somebody who says, you know what? I accepted guilt early on. I cooperated with the government. I assisted in every possible way. And so you see those in plea deals sometimes where the government will preserve the right for an early cooperating witness to move for a downward departure, right? They will say, look, we're going to agree to a sentencing guideline range here, you know, as per the chart, but we're going to leave it free and we will not oppose. That is also sometimes a condition that you'll see in federal plea agreements. If your lawyer moves the court for a downward departure to go less than the sentencing guidelines. And so long as you truthfully recount what happens, we won't oppose that. And so axiomatically, as a function of making those kinds of motions, the very first thing you say is, my client displays full remorse for what they've done. Mm-hmm. They immediately knew that it was wrong. They went and pled guilty and cooperated. And right, like those are the kinds of things that tell you in a criminal justice system that this person won't do it again. And I'm kind of shocked that you would make an argument to the contrary in this. The other argument that's sort of embedded in that is just another terrible argument that says, you know, from 2014 to 2018, actually, I think this is a positive sign for the criminal justice system. It says, of those defendants with a zero criminal history, right, 14% of them got a reduced sentence. And then it points out that one of the commonalities is that crimes were committed with the lack of a dangerous weapon.
Oh.
They've actually made that argument here of like, look, you know, it's not like he was using, you know, firearm or taser or whatever. Again, this seems like at best a wash, like he was wearing a firearm and right? Like
if under the threat of a gun, you do like brutally murder someone by hand. It's not like, well, I didn't use the gun.
That literally is the argument that is made in this motion. And again, if that strikes you as not a great argument, I think we are probably in fairly significant agreement at that point.
Well, what about the idea? I mean, you said earlier the idea of not committing it again. You know, don't hate me, but like just arguing on Chauvin's side here. Is there any place where they're like, look, he only could do this because he was a police officer and he's never going to be a police officer again. So like, does that mitigate the risk of reoffending?
The risk of reoffending is not.
Oh, that's like a parole thing, I guess.
Yeah, it's not part of the... No, it's a great question.
But you mentioned like not... I thought you mentioned like he's not... You can argue like I'm not a risk to do more crime, right? Didn't you say something like that?
Yeah, no, that is exactly right, right? So what you're trying to do here in a downward departure memorandum is you're trying to say for other similarly situated criminal defendants, this one is particularly better, right? Like the sentencing chart is meant to describe the average first-time offender of second-degree murder, right? And I'm going to show you in my memorandum, if I'm doing the best job for my client that I can, why the general circumstances that lead you to conclude 12 and a half years for somebody with a zero criminal history are not present here, right? That this person is even better than that. And so, yeah, like the kinds of things you're describing are the kinds of things to which I suspect when the prosecutors file their reply will say, yeah, this is, you're pointing out, right? Those kinds of things are already inherent in the table. So you can point out lack of risk of reoffending, right? So the classic, he's not a serial murderer, right?
Okay.
But he's a murderer, right? And so, yeah.
So you're saying essentially that's already been accounted for in the, how we got here in the first place.
Right. That is exactly right. And so what this has to show you is this person is better than in ways that are not taken into account in the sentencing guidelines, a typical defendant. And so far, and that's what the first two arguments were directed at. And then the third argument is, right, well, at least you shouldn't find the aggravation that you found. And here's where they make in this brief the only good legal argument, which again, when I look at this and I read this from an outside perspective, I think I would have done my best to lead with the only good argument and sort of make it in the context of everything. So let's talk about the bad arguments that are made even in this section. So this is section three. Don't at least just give us the 12 and a half years, right? Like, don't give us an aggravated upward departure of a greater than guideline sentence. So what they have to do there is rebut the four findings that the court made that we detailed on this show as to why an upward departure was necessary. And those four findings were number one, excessive cruelty. And here the argument is that, you know, this is really just a garden variety third degree assault that was the underlying assault. It wasn't particularly cruel because, and again, quoting directly from the memorandum, the infliction of substantial bodily injury necessarily causes pain. The assault of Mr. Floyd occurred in the course of a very short time, involved no threats or taunting, such as putting a gun to his head and pulling the trigger, and ended when EMS, the emergency medical services, finally responded to officers' calls. In fact, the fact that officers called the ambulance served to mitigate any cruelty with which Mr. Floyd had been treated. Officers called an ambulance before the struggle began and upgraded the call during the struggle. It was the arrival of the ambulance within minutes that ended the incident, which is not how I would describe this case, but it's how they argue in the brief. So that's their argument on particular cruelty, that, hey, look, we called for an ambulance. That doesn't seem great. Their argument against the fact that he abused his position of trust is that no case has ever held that in the context of police officer, which is true, but again, not a great argument. The argument against the aggravating factor that it was in front of children is that the other cases all involved kids who were unable to leave the scene, right? So it was either like a home invasion or one was a mass shooting at a daycare. And here the idea is they're kind of just bystanders. They're kind of hanging around. Again, evaluate that as you see fit. I mean, to me, it seems as though it meets that requirement, particularly combined with the other two factors. The one argument they make that I think is good is made on the second to the last page of the brief. And it says, this is page 15. The court found that this was undertaken in connection with three or more offenders. And you may recall that when the court made that finding, expressed some shock, right? I was like, I didn't expect them to do that.
Because you didn't want it to like bear on the other trials at all and maybe risk that if one of them's found innocent, then it says that that factor would maybe be not appropriate. And so then he could appeal it, right?
That's exactly right. And that is exactly the argument that Chauvin's lawyers make in this brief. They say the defense fails to understand how this court could find beyond a reasonable doubt, because that is the requirement, before any evidence has been presented in their cases, meaning the other officers, that Mr. Chauvin's co-defendants actively participated in the crime of which Derek Chauvin has been convicted. At this point, the co-defendants have merely been charged with accomplice liability, which places the burden on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the co-defendants intentionally aided Mr. Chauvin in the commission of the offense. That means that they must have been aware of Mr. Chauvin's intent to commit third-degree assault, and the state has not yet met its burden of proving as such, and the co-defendants must be presumed innocent of the alleged offenses. That's all true. There is an ongoing trial, and that trial is not a foregone conclusion for precisely the intent-based standard that is just set out there. I think the judge is going to take a look at that, and for the arguments that I've said, in order to bulletproof the finding on appeal, strike that particular finding and say, that is correct. I shouldn't have said three or more offenders. There are only three aggravating factors here, but three is more than enough for me to give an upward departure and a sentence that is longer than the sentencing guidelines. So that's my prediction, but that's the breakdown of what the defense is asking for.
So we're not getting detention.
We are not getting detention.
But you think maybe, to sum it up, maybe not quite as long as would have been if the judge just went with what they already said.
I don't know that it will affect the sentence, right? I think the question is that the judge has in mind is I want to send a message that this was particularly heinous, that this involved somebody that the community trusted and for which we have this background condition of the idea of, you call the police to get you out of a difficult situation, not to put you in one. And I really think that struck at sort of the core of the judge here. And then the precise circumstances with cruelty. And I might add that, sort of lack of remorse as an additional fight, like his counsel.
Yeah, the judge be like, you're making it worse, buddy. Like,
yeah, I would absolutely 100% say that. Say, yep, they're right in terms of what the state can consider in terms of cooperating with multiple offenders. That doesn't change our analysis that this is a particularly heinous crime and particularly deserves an upward departure. That would be my prediction.
This show is brought to you by Magic Spoon. Folks, I'm sure you've probably heard of Magic Spoon before. You know what it is. You know it's a healthy alternative to breakfast cereal. You know it doesn't have all the sugar and the carbs and the junk. But I want to tell you something that maybe you haven't heard before, which is I realized as I looked at the nutrition facts on the back of my delicious Magic Spoon cereal, I realized it's almost like a protein shake or protein bar. Like I have consumed protein bars and protein shakes that have roughly the same nutrition facts. So Magic Spoon can be your delicious way to get your protein after a workout, which I think is as delightful as it is funny. Like, I got to get my after workout bowl of cereal, but like, no, but really. So here's the stuff you need to know about Magic Spoon. It's got 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. It's only 140 calories a serving, which for me means I'm probably having 2 servings. It's keto friendly, gluten free, grain free, soy free, and low carb. And they've got a variety pack. The 4 flavors are cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. And they are delicious. This tastes like your childhood cereal, but it's nutritious. So if you're excited to do a post-workout bowl of cereal, go to magicspoon.com/opening to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code opening at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/opening and use the code opening to save $5 off. Thanks to Magic Spoon for sponsoring this episode.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
You rest your case?
What? Oh, no, I thought that was just a figure of speech. Case closed.
All right, let's talk about the actual only cancel culture that really exists in our society, which is right-wing cancel culture, historically.
Yeah.
actual case... I won't go into an entire thing, Andrew, but every time I research the alleged left-wing cancel culture, the stories are badly misrepresented and aren't at all what the IDW conservative whoever's Ben Shapiro's are saying they are. And then... when there's an actual like right-wing canceling, it's fairly severe. It's, for example, states are right now passing laws saying you can't teach critical race theory. They're banning books, essentially. They're banning education. Like actual using real power to actually cancel people by law. That seems to be the asymmetry that I see. Let's see if this is an example of this. You may have heard of this really funny... a flyer that was put out by a student. And so why don't you give us the details of this, Andrew?
Yeah. So we're going to back into it, but doesn't hurt to lead with. This is an absolutely hilarious parody flyer that Stanford law student 3L, graduating law student Nick Wallace created, that said the Stanford Federalist Society presents the originalist case for inciting insurrection to be held Wednesday, January 6th from 12:45 p.m. to 2 p.m. And that, quote, riot information will be emailed the morning of the event. Okay.
You better get to the Grubhub coupon.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, but wait, there's more, Andrew.
It says the first 30 students to RSVP will receive a $10 Grubhub coupon to be used on the day of the event. And then there's an asterisk, man. It's funny.
It's really funny.
And it reminded me of sort of a less funny but still obviously parodical graphic and meme that made its way around about a year ago this time that was like the, you know, Antifa barbecue and child face painting thing, right? And again,
child face painting.
Yeah, no, and right, that was
that's
right.
Good,
so,
funny.
Yeah, it's that's reasonably funny, right? It was like, yeah, show up, we're going to, teach you how to, burn government buildings and there'll be a face painting tent for the kids, right? So, okay. I think we're both very plainly on the side of let people parody as terms of political free speech. Shocker, the extreme right wing is absolutely not on board with your right to make fun of the Federalist Society. We're going to get all the way through that, by the way.
Do we need to teach the Federalist Society about the First Amendment? Like, isn't that their whole,
we do.
Their whole thing?
We okay. do. Yeah. Well,
they're pretty into those amendments, I thought.
Yeah. Because weirdly, despite the fact that, all of these individuals involved will have like proud 1A defender on their Twitter profiles, they mean that, and I want to be very, very clear about this, they mean that only when they're talking about protecting your right to say racist things. Okay. And lest you think I'm being hyperbolic in that, I want us to time travel back to the 1970s for just a minute. So pre-1970, college campuses were basically places for white men, that with the exception of historically women's colleges, you know, largely in Massachusetts, which were places for white women.
Hmm.
And, you know, we've talked about that. This question has come up. We talked about like law school and how few, you know, we just answered a Q&A question on, you know, how few women there are in the law. It's still 2-1 men in 2021. So, you know, that this is, again, on a lawyer timeline, 50 years ago is still reasonably recent history. In the 1970s was when colleges started significantly increasing and recruiting minority applicants, women and members of racial minorities. Shocker, as colleges were reaching out to women and minority students, and I'll include the link to this in the show notes, quote, as a result of expanded recruiting efforts, incidents of racist, homophobic, and sexist harassment at colleges also increased. So what colleges began to do to respond to this threat on campuses. By the way, this is something about which I have changed my mind 100% in the course of doing this show. Right? So in the course of actually looking at the laws, is they crafted college campus speech codes. And those speech codes, the first one crafted by the University of Wisconsin, prohibited offensive or intolerant speech directed at individuals and groups on the basis of their race, color, religion, ethnicity, disability, sex, age, sexual orientation, and then later gender identity, right? So I'm going to explicitly talk about the one at Stanford, because, you know, this Federalist Society case is also a Stanford case, right? So in the 1980s, Stanford's speech code prohibited, quote, discriminatory intimidation by threats of violence. That's a separate crime. And also includes personal vilification of students on the basis of their sex, race, color, handicap, religion, sexual orientation, or national and ethnic origin. That's the only part that's not of the speech code that doesn't prohibit an explicit crime. You would say what counts as personal vilification. Personal vilification was defined in the speech code as speech that A, is intended to insult or stigmatize an individual or small number of individuals on the basis of their characteristics, sex, race, color, blah, blah, blah. And B, is addressed directly to the individual or individuals to whom it insults or stigmatizes. And C, makes the use of insulting or fighting words or nonverbal symbols. Okay, so that's it. So think about the things that does not prevent, right? That does not prevent student A from telling a gross racist joke to student B, so long as it's two white kids, you know, telling those student jokes.
Wow.
It does not prevent student A from developing and discussing in a class, right? Talking about, I mean, the bell curve hadn't been written yet, but yeah, if you wanted to express a gross racist wrong opinion, if you wanted to say, you know, I think that there is, you know, white genocide going on in the United States right now, and I think historic, right? And say white nationalist stuff in your class, that is not addressed directly to the individual or individuals to whom that stigmatized. So this is truly as minor.
A bare minimum.
Yeah. And look, the reason for that, and we have talked about this before, we have talked about Mari Matsuda's groundbreaking work, Words That Wound. The reason is, as you are attempting to get to a critical mass of minority students on a college campus, right? You don't go from 0% to, you know, wherever that is, 10%, 15%, whatever, overnight. Like, somebody has got to be, right, the first African-American student on campus, or the first two, or the first three. And that's the time.
Historically, that's been a tough thing to do.
Yeah, real tough in every field. And so to say, hey, maybe on a campus that's 98% white, you shouldn't find the handful of black people and stand in front of them and say insulting things on the basis of their race. That's literally all this speech code says. As a result of this, and as a result of the free market in action, there were approximately 75 universities with speech codes by 1990. That went to 300 by 1991. So basically everywhere, right? This became the best practice for secondary, post-secondary college education. Everybody adopted them. This idea that you could now no longer directly insult to their face minority members led Republicans to freak the hell out. And so Republican Bill Leonard of California, state senator, wrote what is today called the Leonard Law in 1992. It is section 94367 of the California Education Code. And it says, no private post-secondary educational institution shall make or enforce a rule subjecting a student to disciplinary sanctions solely on the base of conduct or speech or other communication that, when engaged in outside of the campus of or facility of the private post-secondary institution, is protected from government restriction by the First Amendment or by Section 2, Article 1 of the California Constitution, which is California's First Amendment. And then creates a right of action in which you can get your attorney's fees if a school violates those provisions. Immediately upon passage of this Leonard Law, a group of individuals led by Robert Corey, I think was a student at Stanford, but I don't know. And the reason that I don't know is because what we have is a court, is a trial court's order, a state trial court's order on a preliminary injunction from 30 years ago. So, you know, like this is really hard to find stuff. It's not available on Westlaw. But in any event, the case was called Corey versus Stanford. They moved for a preliminary injunction and the court granted it. And the court's reason, so preventing Stanford from enforcing its speech code now that they'd passed the Leonard Law. And the reason was that the speech code prohibits not just the kind of speech that is prohibited by fighting by the Supreme Court's fighting words doctrine, mm-hmm. right, which is likely to lead to imminent lawless action, right, which or the way this court put it, will not only cause people to react violently, but also cause them to feel insulted or stigmatized. The speech code punishes words that are commonly understood to convey hatred and contempt on the basis of race, religion, etc. Clearly, this focuses upon the content of the words. All that is required under the speech code is that the words convey a message of hatred and contempt, not that they will likely cause an imminent breach of the peace. By prescribing those words, the speech code fails to meet the very narrow fighting word standard set forth in the principal case from this is Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire from the Supreme Court. So that's what the court said, right? Now that we're treating speech inside a college campus exactly identical to speech on the street, the standard is incredibly narrow, and none of the considerations that you might think would come into play on a college campus would come into play here. And we cannot prohibit you from saying hateful racist stuff unless that hateful racist stuff is like, you know, you're screaming it an inch away from someone's face, right? And therefore likely to meet the fighting word standard. But yeah, you wanna organize a big, you know, neo-Nazi parade, great, go for it.
And this isn't just like in the, I know we've talked in previous college cases before, like the public square, if something's like the quad or whatever, you know, it's not just that. We're talking
in California because of that particular Leonard Law, right? Hmm. It is a college cannot discipline a student for engaging in speech that they could engage in if they were not on the college campus, right? So that's so that's the test, right? Would this otherwise be protected speech in a different context?
Jeez.
It is, yeah. And that's, and by the way,
it seems like a tough way to run a school. What things work like that? Schools don't work that way. Your job doesn't work that way. Like, that's not how anything works.
Correct.
Did this start with a good place? Like, was this out of the, like, liberal free speech movement, or are we...
Nope. This was directly as a result, right? 1992. This was a direct result to college campus free speech codes.
Wow.
That's why they passed the law to say colleges in California can't have them anymore. They cannot have a code of conduct that prohibits certain kind of speech for the benefit of an educational institution, even if it is, you know, of the sort that I described previously of Stanford's, right?
Unbelievably modest. Is that not quite bizarre?
Yeah.
So, that seems quite bizarre.
But okay, you're thinking, all right, well, what that means is those Republicans are diehard First Amendment free speechers, right? Like you get to say on campus anything that you could say off campus.
This show is brought to you by X Chair. You know it. I've said it a million times. I'm in my X Chair right now. It is a comfy place from which to deliver you this message. I love my X Chair. I have never had an office chair that feels this amazing in my life. It's so comfortable that I can, and I need to, sit for hours and get work done, get recording done, get editing done. The secret is their patented dynamic variable lumbar, which is DVL support, which offers unbelievable lumbar support to my lower back. But now, also thanks to their new XHMT technology, I can get heat and massage therapy while I'm sitting at my desk. Instead of my old uncomfortable office chair, now I look forward to spending hours sitting in the ultimate therapeutic massager. The XHMT delivers heat and massage technology straight to my core, helping increase blood flow, muscle recovery, and energy, all perks that make working from home or the office a joy. It even has 4 different massage modes and fast warming heat technology for therapy when I'm sore. You won't believe the X Chair difference until you feel the X Chair difference for yourself. Trust me. This is a luxury supercar of office chairs. X Chair is on sale now for $100 off. Go to xchairoa.com now. That's the letter X, chair, the letters ONA.com, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR. X Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. Go to xchairoa.com now and use code XWheels for free X-Wheel blade casters. One more time, xchairoa.com.
So now, let's fast forward to 2021 from 1994 and perhaps revisit Nick Wallace's parody flyer, which, you know, we read the first part of this. By the way, this email was sent. So this was sent as an email on the internal Stanford Law student listserv. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like a couple hundred people who are law students, professors have access to this. Right. That's it. This is basically the equivalent of like posting it in the campus quad. Right. And the fake flyer was sent around on January 25th, 3 weeks after the Capitol insurrection. Right. So no possible danger that anybody thinking about this for a tenth of a second could have thought that, you know, this was a real event. But, you know, okay, you're reading, you're not carefully, you miss the riot information will be emailed, you miss the Grubhub coupon. Here's the text. This is the full text. I'm going to read this because it's delightful. Please join the Stanford Federalist Society as we welcome Senator Joshua Hawley and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton to discuss violent insurrection. Violent insurrection, also known as doing a coup, is a classical system of installing a government. Although widely believed to conflict in every way with the rule of law, violent insurrection can be an effective approach to upholding the principle of limited government. Senator Hawley will argue that the ends justify the means. Attorney General Paxton will explain that when the Supreme Court refuses to exercise its Article III authority to overturn the results of a free and fair election, calling on a violent mob to storm the Capitol represents an appropriate alternative remedy.
Is it satire?
That led somebody whose name has been redacted to protect this person and others from Stanford's Federalist Society to file a 1.5-page complaint with the university accusing this student, Nicholas N. Wallace, who, by the way, like wants his name to be public, right? Like he's communicated with Mark Stern from Slate. Like that's why we're using his name and not the cowards who wrote this. It says, On January 25th, 2021 at 8:38 a.m., Nicholas Wallace sent an email to Stanford Law School's Law Talk email listserv where he impersonated the Stanford Federalist Society, a student group, through a false event flyer and attributed false and defamatory beliefs to the persons that he listed on the event flyer. And then it, you know, describes the situation. It says he clearly impersonated by, you know, labeling it as being the Stanford Federalist Society Presents and, you know, use their logo, and this is easily recognizable to other students. And then it complains at the end, other student groups have asked to cancel joint events planned with the Federalist Society as a result of the controversy created by this email. Good. And we, as officers of the organization, feel that our individual reputations have been harmed. So, Federalist Society, stalwart defenders of freedom of speech, whined about a parody email. It caused Stanford to not only open up disciplinary proceedings against Nicholas Wallace, but that placed a hold on his graduation. This is in the middle of finals week, right? And I can tell you, like, look, even as a 3L, like, you... like your finals are hard. You care about cramming for finals. And, you know, the difference between getting good grades throughout, like, you know, are you graduating with honors? Like, look, it is 100% clear how this materially interferes with a graduating student's expectations from the university. You can't register to take the bar if they've got a hold on your diploma, right? Like, all sorts of things. Now, the good news is, thanks only, right, to Mark Joseph Stern of Slate Magazine, who broke the story yesterday. As we are recording this today, he was contacted by a Stanford spokesperson who says that the school has dropped the investigation. And then Nick Wallace sent around an email to the entire listserv that says, I just wanted to let you know that the Office of Community Standards has dropped the complaint against me and the degree conferral hold has been lifted from my account. Thank you for your support in personal messages, in satirical Law Talk emails, and so many other ways you've shown what a wonderful community we have over here. I hope this is not the end of the conversation we've been having. With that in mind, I hope to work with Stanford in the little time that I have left to make sure no other student is subjected to an abusive process in this way again, and to develop better protections for its students' freedom of expression. Thanks for your support. P.S. This email is not satire. and so, again, let's explain the significance of that. Unquestionably, under the Leonard Law, Nicholas Wallace had a knock-dead, just a 100% likelihood of success of suing Stanford, right?
Yeah.
Could have
Though, Andrew, is that there aren't any lawyers at this law school to be able to, you know, say, like, to evaluate the law. This poor law school, how would they know the law? I don't understand how the law school is supposed to know that this is obviously free speech that's legal in every context and ever.
So
how would they know? There's this poor law school. Oh, wait, they're law school. God, I can't. I've seen all the tweets. It's good. There's been a lot of response. I think Lawrence Tribe was like, hey, isn't this a law school? Essentially, like Lawrence Tribe said, mocking an ideologically based group can't be made a basis for denying academic privileges in any open society worthy of respect. If accurate, this report shows Stanford Law School to be unworthy of treatment as an academic institution. Student complaint. You should investigate complaints. The school should have been like, oh, okay, well, we take complaints seriously. We want to make sure everything's going on above board here. Nobody's harassing anybody or anything bad. And then you look at it and be like, oh, well, okay, dismiss. Like, it should have been like a 1 week process.
Yep.
God.
Yeah. No, that is exactly right. And again, right, let's be clear about this, that this was sent the same day, January 25th, right? So, yeah, it does not take 4 months to look at a flyer that very clearly meets the First Amendment standards for parody, right? We have talked about that, right? Like that is the Falwell v. Flint case, right? That is a parody ad for Campari liqueur, right? That uses the logo of Campari, but like it's totally obvious that nobody reading it would think like Jerry Falwell really gave an interview to Playboy, to Hustler magazine, in which he intimated that the first time he had sexual intercourse was with his mom in the outhouse after they kicked out the goat. Just like nobody could look at this and think that the Stanford Federalist Society wanted to time travel to, you know, give out cookies so that, you know, you
I
could,
mean, like, or even if they did, like, yeah, that is kind of what.
Right. Look, but anyway. Let's bring this full circle. Well,
here's what I want to say, though, if you don't mind. So I thought you were going to take us through a further legal history that would lead us to not that current state of things. Are you telling me that even today in California school universities, you can say anything that is protected outside of universities and never face discipline from the university for it, as long as it wouldn't be illegal speech?
So I will read you the few exceptions that are contained within the Leonard Law, right? So I already read you A. B is what gives you the right to sue and says that you can get attorney's fees. C says this does not apply to an institution that is controlled by a religious organization, because of course it doesn't.
Yeah, what do you know?
To the extent that the application of this section would not be consistent with the religious tenets of the organization. So again, remember, right, when your right-wing Uncle Frank is talking about how much liberals hate the First Amendment, religious right-wing organizations went to the legislature and said, yeah, we want the First Amendment to apply everywhere. I mean, not to us, of course.
Yeah.
And that the worst, most restrictive, most horrendous speech codes anywhere are those imposed by right-wing evangelical organizations, right? You can be expelled from Liberty University for watching a PG-13 movie.
Isn't it pretty ironic that this very same amendment that protects religion from the state, also they're like, we don't count that one against us, though. We want to violate that on other people.
Yep, isn't that weird? Exactly right. So, doesn't apply to religious schools. That's subsection C. Subsection D does not authorize the prior restraint of student speech. That is also roughly consistent with the First Amendment, right? We've talked about that before. Generally, in free speech cases, you get the right to say your thing. And then, you know, if it's defamatory, you have damages or whatever. Only in very, very limited cases involving unquestionable national security, the inverse of the Pentagon Papers cases, or, you know, some other incredible edge cases, can you get injunctive relief preventing somebody from publishing something. Right? Mm-hmm. So, okay. Says, does not authorize prior restraint. Subsection E, this is, I think, where you're going, but this is how narrow it is E and F. E, this section does not prohibit the imposition of discipline for harassment, threats, or intimidation, comma, unless constitutionally protected.
Isn't that an important comma? Because like a lot of harassment is constitutionally protected that you wouldn't want on a student perpetrating on another student at your campus. That I'm just shocked that that's
correct.
You know?
Yep.
I mean, okay. I just want to say, like, I do think free speech is really important on universities, contrary to what the typical like SJW stereotype is. I do think it's really important, but I think there are some pretty no nonsense, obvious exceptions that I'm kind of surprised we don't have. You know, and I did want to say, like, I was trying to imagine the alternative here, you know, like what if this is a flyer that makes fun of a bunch of typical SJW stuff, you know, oh, trigger, we'll have the trigger warnings, which by the way, that happens all the time. People make those flyers all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like as long as they aren't targeting anyone by their race or these other, you know, other characteristics that I think are protected by law. You know, yeah, it's satire. It wouldn't be satire I'd agree with, but that's, you know, that's
right.
Protected. I would never want an administration to be withholding a diploma because of a satirical flyer that probably wouldn't be funny because the right wing can't meme.
Yeah. Well, 100%. Think about it. We before going through this deep dive, we talked about that Antifa 4th of July barbecue, right? It is 100%. I mean, even though, you know, could you craft an argument of, you know, how you're probably punching down with that, right? Because all conservative humor pretty much is punching down. Yeah, you could. But again, I wouldn't want a student to be disciplined for creating or sending that, right? We said that at the outset, right? If the idea is you protect free speech and you want to express the belief, and what that does is expresses the belief that Antifa is, you know, a hypocritical organization that, you know, says they're fighting fascism, but, you know, they promote and condone violence during protests, right? There are a million things wrong with that idea, but free speech says, and I think you and I would defend, particularly on a college campus, the right to start that discussion, no matter how crudely you're starting that discussion.
Yeah, and the key is he's mocking a group that's ideological. As Lawrence Tribe said, I mean, it'd be one thing if he took like the student who was the president of the, you know, campus Federalist Society and was mocking that person or even joking about characteristics about them. Like, that'd be a different story. Like, I would, you know, I still don't know based on what you've told me. I'm still very unclear as to how much you can get away with on campuses. But like, if I were in charge, I'd be like, yeah, that's not cool. Even if they are a Federalist Society dweeb.
Like, yeah.
Can't do that. But like, you can make fun of the society itself. Come on.
The society itself. Yeah, absolutely. If making fun of the Federalist Society is wrong, I don't want to be right. Yeah. I want to say for completeness, because we got off on subsection F also says that, and this is the last one, that educational institutions may adopt rules and regulations to prevent hate violence as narrowly defined, quote, so long as the rules and regulations conform to standards established by the First Amendment. So
it always comes back to that. Like every single time I think, oh, there's a carve out there that, oh no, it's still... Nope. Still, yeah.
If you're asking in California, can you create a separate set of rules restricting the subset of free speech that you would otherwise expect not on a college environment? The answer is no.
Quite surprised by that. Okay.
So there you go.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons on patreon.com/law. Hope you're enjoying all the goodies. That Q&A was a lot of fun on Monday, was that? Yeah, Monday. And the audio goes out to the patron thread. So new patrons, you know, if you missed it, you can hear that high quality audio that I definitely remember to upload on time every time. And thank you to Bill from Chicago, David Fox, Ross P., Michael, Cameron Gillies, and Sarah Walker. Your turn, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you to David J. Patterson, to Tort Phaser Set to Stun.
Nice.
To Jacob Greenleaf, Michael McDonnell, and to Brian Johnson. Thank you all so much for supporting the show over at patreon.com/law. Give us as little as a buck an episode and you'll get all this sort of great stuff.
We got Michael McDonald, huh?
Yeah, McDonnell, but still, you know, if he's the brains behind...
If I have to hear Yamo be there one more time.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. Still going with the coin, although at this point the coin may tap out. I think the coin may have mathematically failed by now. We'll see.
All right, Thomas. A company contracted with a builder to construct a new corporate headquarters for a fixed price of $100 million. At the time of the contract, structural steel was widely available and was included in the contract as a $6 million item. Before work began on the project, tornado damage shut down the production facility of the biggest structural steel supplier in the country, and the price of structural steel increased by 20% as a result. The builder informed the company of the steel price increase, and the parties then orally agreed to increase the project price to $101 million. The builder proceeded with construction and delivered the project on time. The company paid the builder $100 million, but refused to pay the additional million. If the builder sues the company for $1 million, is the builder likely to prevail? A. No, because the modification was never reduced to a writing signed by the party to be charged. B. No, because there was no consideration for the modification of the contract.
Okay.
C. Yes, because the company's promise was supported by consideration. Or D, yes, because the modification was fair and equitable in view of the unanticipated increase in the price of structural steel.
Man, this is a tough one. Is this a statute of frauds or whatever? It's always a weirdly named thing for when stuff can be oral contracts or not. I think that's what it is. Anyway, can you orally agree to increase a price in a major thingy like this? Wow, tricky question. Okay, right off the bat, I guess my instincts are it's pretty messed up to orally agree, yeah, $101 million, and then stiff the guy who still finished on time, you know, and they orally agreed like kind of before work began. I don't know if that matters, but, you know, it feels pretty messed up. So you would hope that the builder could prevail just like, I don't know, morally. But does the law line up with that? A, no, because the modification was never reduced to a writing signed by the party to be charged. So that's just basically like was the oral agreement okay, or did you need to write this out? And that's tricky. Based on my limited knowledge, like, it's kind of weird the things that you're allowed to do in oral contract versus not. It's actually shocking the extent to which you're allowed to do oral contracts sometimes, but it's tricky and I don't remember which things that is. And then there's some weird exceptions where you can't, and I'm not a law student, so I haven't memorized those. I don't remember. B is an interesting one. It could be a attractive distractor, because it says no because there's no consideration for the modification of the contract, which is a contracty thing where it's like when you sign a contract, there has to be consideration, but this is modifying a contract. I don't know why you would need another round of consideration, but maybe that's how it works. C, yes, because the company's promise was supported by consideration. That's a weird one. D, yes, because the modification was fair and equitable in view of the unanticipated increase in the price of structural steel. Now, D is a weird one because this is one that I think historically I would have found pretty attractive, but now I'm not sure I do, because D kind of shortcuts all the contract issues. You know, that D says, well, what's the spirit of the thing? Like, what's the actual fairness of the price? You know, and like, doesn't. So that would almost sidestep all the, like, did you need to write it down? Did you need to agree orally? Now, it's still possible that, like, D is a step in the chain that you would evaluate, you know, when the parties can't agree kind of thing, and maybe it could be right, but I'm actually leaning away from D, even though it could be my second best answer. We'll see. Boy, I could really see an argument for several of the answers. So A would be no, because the modification was never reduced to a writing. This is weird language, but maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's law talk. I'm not a law talking guy. Signed by the party to be charged. I'm not in love with that language. Like, it's kind of weird. Signed. If it's a modification, you would think it would just be, we're both agreeing to modify the contract, so we both sign it. That wording is kind of turning me off. Like, the modification was never reduced to a writing signed by the party to be charged. If you're just modifying a contract, both people need to sign it, I think. I could be reading too much into that, though. I'm not in love with that language. So B, the argument for A would be, forget everything I just said about the weird language and you just need to write it down. B, no, because there was no consideration for the modification. The consideration thing is actually interesting. I think if you already have a contract and you're modifying it, do you need consideration again? Or is it like it's taking the form of a new contract on top of this one or something? I don't know. C, yes, because the company's promise was supported by consideration. I think I don't like C. So D has the most plausible language, but it's like that would be under the theory that the only reason you can orally modify this contract is if the modification is fair and equitable. But like otherwise you'd have to write it down, which seems, that just doesn't seem right to me. Like that doesn't, that, like I said earlier, that seems to be sidestepping the question. God, this is the weirdest thing in the world. I could see an argument for all of these. And I don't like A. I hate the writing of A. I'm almost weirdly between B and C now. This is, oh my God, I'm lost. B, no, because there was no consideration. Do you need consideration to modify a contract? I know you need consideration in a contract. Or C, yes, because the company's promise was supported by consideration. You know what? This is friggin' weird. I think I'm going with C. You're going to tell me I've lost my mind. That's okay. I don't like any of the answers. I think I'm between A and B and C and D.
between all four of them?
Yeah. Look, we all have a bad day. I can't figure this out. I think I'm between B and C, weirdly. I'm going to see if the coin agrees with me. We'll take it as a good sign if it does. The coin agrees with me. Okay, so the coin and I, again, choose C. Second choice answer was B. I have zero confidence in this. I'm looking forward to the audience response. So make sure to play along, everybody.
All right. And if you want to play along, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right, that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in for that very important deep dive on some Christian scams. So you're going to want to hear it. You're going to want to share it. Tune in on Tuesday, patrons, Sunday night. We'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.